You know, if I told you to imagine taking the most powerful psychedelic molecule known to humanity, like a molecule so insanely potent that when it is smoked or intravenously injected, it reliably produces, one of the most intense reality-shattering experiences in all of pharmacology.
Right. You would naturally assume that swallowing it would be a major physical event.
Exactly. You would completely brace yourself for impact, right?
It definitely stands to reason that introducing something with that kind of binding affinity to your neuroreceptors would trigger a massive cascade, pretty much regardless of the route of administration.
But here is the biological paradox we are starting with today. If you take that exact same molecule, pure N-dimethyltryptamine or DMT, and you simply swallow it, well, absolutely nothing happens to you.
Yeah, nothing at all.
You could drink an entire beaker of this stuff, and you would just go about your Tuesday as if you had drank a glass of tap water.
It is entirely inert, orally, just a complete non-event, which, from an evolutionary and biological standpoint, is a fascinating mystery all on its own.
It really is.
Especially when you consider the ubiquity of the molecule in nature.
And it gets even weirder, right? Because your own body actually produces trace amounts of this molecule endogenously.
Yeah.
Like it's already in our lungs, our eyes, our brains.
Yeah, we synthesize it ourselves.
But despite that deep biological familiarity, if you take a macrodose orally, your biology completely neutralizes it. It stops it dead in its tracks before it even gets close to your central nervous system.
It's an incredibly robust defense mechanism.
But, and this is a massive but, for centuries, indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin have been brewing a highly specific tea that completely bypasses this biological roadblock.
They did. They somehow figured out how to make that exact same fragile molecule orally active.
Turning what should be a pharmacological non-event into this hours-long, profoundly disruptive neurological journey.
And they managed to do it with a level of pharmacological precision that modern Western science didn't even begin to understand until the mid-20th century, let alone replicate it.
It is genuinely mind-blowing when you look at the mechanics of it. And that is exactly what we are exploring in this deep dive. I was reading a fascinating piece in the August 2, 2026 issue of the OOTW Journal.
Oh, yeah, the article titled Ayahuasca, the DMT plus MAOI trick that makes it work.
That's the one. Our mission today is to look past the mystical terminology that usually surrounds ayahuasca. So we are setting aside terms like vine of the soul or, the grandmother or the plant teacher.
Right, we're focusing entirely on decoding the elegant, practical, and honestly unbelievable pharmacology behind this brew.
Because we want to map out exactly how this ancient combination of plants manages to hack human biochemistry.
Yeah, because once you understand the physical trick at the center of it, the actual mechanism of action, everything else about the experience starts to make perfect sense.
Like why it lasts so long, right?
Exactly. Or why it is currently at the center of major clinical trials for treatment-resistant depression.
And also why it carries very specific, very severe physical risks.
All of that traces back to this one biochemical trick.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can even begin to understand how ayahuasca creates this sustained journey, we first have to understand the biological brick wall that stops oral DMT in its tracks in the first place.
Right, the baseline problem.
Yeah. Why does swallowing this incredibly potent tryptamine do absolutely nothing?
The answer comes down to a very specific, highly efficient enzymatic defense system in your body. We are talking about monoamine oxidase, or MAO for short.
MAO. And you will find this enzyme primarily lining the walls of your gastrointestinal tract, right? And it's also heavily concentrated in your liver.
Yeah, that's exactly where it lives. And MAO has a very demanding day job. Its primary function in the human body is to catalyze the oxidation of a specific class of molecules called monoamines.
So what does that actually mean, oxidation?
It literally strips an amine group off the molecule, and by doing that, it renders the molecule completely inactive.
Okay, and when we say monoamines, we are talking about some of the fundamental building blocks of our neurochemistry, right, and our diet.
We are. So serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, these are all monoamines.
Got it.
But MAO isn't just looking for endogenous neurotransmitters. It is aggressively hunting for dietary amines, which are biologically active compounds found in many of the everyday foods we eat.
So this enzyme is constantly working, constantly oxidizing and dismantling these molecules as they pass through your digestive system long before they can ever reach systemic circulation.
It's an incredibly active system, and here is the punchline for our inert psychedelic. DMT is structurally a monoamine.
So it fits the exact profile.
Precisely. N N-dimethyltryptamine fits the exact substrate profile that MAO is designed to dismantle.
Wow. So when you swallow pure DMT, it moves down your esophagus, hits your stomach, moves into the duodenum of your small intestine, and then it just immediately encounters this vast, densely packed army of MAO enzymes.
Embedded right there in the mitochondrial membranes of your gut lining.
And they just go to work on it with ruthless efficiency.
They dismantle it completely. This is through a process known as first-pass metabolism. The DMT is absorbed by the intestinal villi, it enters the mesenteric veins, and flows directly into the hepatic portal vein.
Which feeds straight into the liver, right?
Exactly. And the liver is essentially a massive chemical filtration plant. The hepatocytes in the liver are loaded with even more MAO.
Just in case any slip past the gut.
Right. So by the time that blood leaves the liver and enters the inferior vena cava to be distributed to the rest of the body, the DMA has been completely oxidized into an inactive metabolite.
I think it's called indole-3 acetic acid.
Yes. Your body is so incredibly efficient at this that essentially zero intact DMT molecules ever make it into your systemic bloodstream.
But if it can't get into your bloodstream, it obviously can't cross the blood-brain barrier.
Exactly. And if it can't get to the brain and bind to those receptors, there is absolutely no psychedelic effect.
I like to think of it this way. Imagine your systemic bloodstream is this highly exclusive underground VIP nightclub.
Okay, I like this.
And your brain, specifically the cerebral cortex, is the ultra-exclusive VIP lounge in the back. MAO is the incredibly efficient, completely ruthless bouncer standing at the front door of the club.
Just checking IDs.
Right. Now, this bouncer has one job and one job only. Confiscate any monoamines trying to get in. You can swallow all the DMT you want. You can send an entire crowd of DMT molecules right to the front door. But that bouncer is going to pat every single one of them down.
And strip them of their active credentials.
Exactly. He just tosses them in the alley before they even hear the music, let alone see the dance floor.
The bouncer is undefeated against oral DMT. It is a perfect biochemical barrier.
But, you know, it makes you wonder, why do we even have this bouncer? Like, why is our liver so intent on destroying these molecules? It feels almost like an evolutionary design flaw if it prevents us from accessing these profound states of consciousness.
What's fascinating here is that your body isn't specifically trying to ruin a psychedelic trip. Evolution has absolutely no agenda against DMT.
So what's the point of the bouncer then?
The MAO enzyme is there to maintain baseline physiological homeostasis. It is a critical survival mechanism.
Because of those dietary amines you mentioned earlier.
Yes, exactly. If you did not have MAO in your gut and liver, the everyday foods you eat, things containing various amines like tyramine or histamine, would constantly be crossing into your bloodstream.
And doing what?
Sending your central and peripheral nervous systems into absolute chaos. Your blood pressure would spike dangerously unpredictably, your vascular tone would fluctuate wildly, and your internal chemistry would be violently hijacked just from eating a normal protein-rich lunch.
Oh, wow. So the bouncer is actually a critical security feature, keeping the club safe from constant random riots.
Yes, it keeps your internal environment stable and predictable.
It just happens that DMT fits the exact molecular profile of the troublemakers he's been hired to keep out.
Exactly. The biological wall is there for a very good reason. It is a non-negotiable feature of human digestion and mammalian survival in general.
Which brings us to a massive historical and scientific question. If this biological bouncer is undefeated against oral DMT and first-pass metabolism destroys the molecule every single time, how did traditional cultures in the Amazon manage to get it past the velvet rope?
That is where the pharmacological genius of the brew comes in. Because the secret of ayahuasca isn't just finding one magical, highly potent plant.
Right.
It is entirely about the synergy of combining two very specific, very different plants to execute a biochemical hack.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because they essentially figured out how to distract the bouncer. They found a biochemical key to a biological lock.
They really did.
Let's break down these two plants because this is the core mechanism that makes the whole thing work. According to the OOTW Journal article, plant number one is a leafy shrub called chacruna. The botanical name is Psychotria viridis.
And the chacruna leaf is the source of the DMT. It synthesizes the molecule in its leaves.
Okay, so it's the payload.
Yes, but as we've established, if you were to just harvest a massive pile of these leaves, chew on them, or brew them into a highly concentrated tea by themselves and drink it, you would encounter the exact same problem.
The MAO bouncers.
Exactly. The MAO in your gut and liver would rapidly oxidize the DMT, and nothing would happen.
Right. Plant number one provides the payload, but the payload is orally fragile. It cannot survive the digestive tract. So you need plant number two.
Plant number two is a massive woody jungle liana, a vine called Banisteriopsis copi.
The copi vine.
And it's worth noting that this vine is actually what is properly referred to as ayahuasca in the strictest traditional and etymological sense. The vine itself is the namesake of the brew. The DMT-containing leaf is considered the additive.
Wait, really? That's fascinating. And what does this vine bring to the pharmacological party? Because the vine does not contain any DMT, right?
It contains zero DMT.
So what's in it?
Instead, the copi vine synthesizes and supplies a family of compounds called beta-carboline alkaloids.
Beta-carbolines?
Yeah, and the specific ones we're interested in are known as harmala alkaloids. The big three in the vine are harmin, harmaline, and tetrahydroharmine, or THH.
Harmaline and THH. What do these complex-sounding alkaloids actually do when they hit the highly acidic environment of the human stomach and move into the gut?
They act as what pharmacologists classify as RIMAs.
RIMAs. What does that stand for?
That acronym stands for reversible inhibitors of MAOA.
Reversible inhibitors. So they inhibit or block the monoamine oxidase enzyme.
They do. When you drink the combined brew, these harmala alkaloids from the vine hit your gastrointestinal tract first. They have a very high binding affinity for the active site of the MAO enzyme.
So they get to the bouncer first.
Exactly. They essentially bind to the enzyme, tackle the bouncers at the door, and temporarily lock up their oxidative machinery.
Oh, wait.
They neutralize the enzyme, so they literally cannot do their job of breaking down monoamines.
So the vine goes in and puts the bouncer in a biochemical headlock.
Temporarily, yes. And that word reversible is incredibly important.
Why is that?
Because the harmalas are competitive inhibitors. They don't permanently destroy or degrade your body's enzymes.
Oh, I see. As opposed to other kinds of inhibitors.
Right. Irreversible MAO inhibitors, which were used in early psychiatric medications in the 1950s, actually destroy the enzyme.
That sounds bad.
It is. It means your body has to synthesize entirely new enzymes over a period of weeks, which is dangerous and highly toxic if not managed perfectly. But the harmalas in the vine, however, just temporarily occupy the enzyme for a few hours.
So while the bouncer's in this reversible headlock, unable to check IDs or strip anyone of their credentials, what happens to the DMT?
The DMT from the chacruna leaf, which was ingested at the exact same time, just walks right through the front door.
Unbelievable. It just sneaks right past.
It survives first pass metabolism completely intact. Because the enzymatic defense system has been taken out of action, the DMT is absorbed through the intestinal wall, enters the hepatic portal vein, and passes through the liver without being oxidized.
And then it just keeps going.
Yes. It enters the systemic bloodstream, travels up the carotid arteries to the brain, crosses the blood-brain barrier, and becomes fully, wildly psychoactive.
When you think about it from the perspective of your own biology, when you drink this specific combination of plants, you are essentially administering a temporary software patch to your own liver and gut.
That's a great way to put it.
You are rewriting the fundamental rules of your own digestive metabolism for a tight window of about 4 to 6 hours.
You are intentionally inducing a temporary metabolic deficiency to allow a specific molecule to reach your brain.
It's like you're telling your body, hey, I know your baseline programming usually deletes this file immediately to keep the system stable, but I really need you to pause your firewall so this specific, highly disruptive code can execute.
Exactly.
And by pairing the vulnerable molecule, the DMT payload, with this enzymatic bodyguard, the harmalas from the vine, the brew achieves what should be biologically impossible, oral activity.
It is a stunning pharmacological workaround. You take two plants that do virtually nothing of profound visionary consequence when consumed orally on their own, and by brewing them together, you create a profound, hours-long psychedelic state.
I have to push back on the narrative of how this was discovered, though, because the math here is completely breaking my brain.
It is pretty staggering.
I hear people say, oh, indigenous tribes lived in the jungle for thousands of years. They just tried everything and eventually figured it out. But if neither of these plants does much of anything, when you just swallow them on their own, the idea of random trial and error seems mathematically absurd.
It is statistically highly improbable.
Because we aren't talking about a controlled agricultural garden with 10 different vegetables here. We are talking about the Amazon basin.
The biodiversity is staggering.
There are roughly 80,000 documented vascular plant species out there.
And as the OTW article points out, there is absolutely no obvious sensory cue linking the chacruna leaf to the kapi vine.
They don't even look alike, right?
No, they don't look alike. They don't grow in some perfectly paired symbiotic cluster. They don't share a distinct olfactory profile that would suggest they belong together.
And it's not like you get a mild visionary high from chewing the leaf and a mild high from chewing the vine and you naturally deduce, hey, let's put these together for a super high.
Right, because if you chew the leaf, nothing happens.
And if you chew the vine,
you might get a little nauseous, maybe a slight shift in physical sensation, but you certainly aren't going on a visionary journey. So the trial and error required to find this exact lock and key combination out of nowhere.
The permutations are practically infinite. Trying random combinations of 2, 3, or 4 plants out of 80,000, boiling them down for 12 hours to concentrate the alkaloids, and then drinking the decoction. That would take millennia.
It would. And realistically, you'd end up severely poisoning yourself or suffering liver failure from toxic alkaloids long before you stumbled onto the exact reversible enzymatic inhibitor needed to make oral DMT work.
It represents this unparalleled leap of pre-scientific botanical engineering.
Which raises a profound philosophical and epistemological question about how we view knowledge.
What do you mean?
Well, when anthropologists, ethnobotanists, and pharmacologists ask traditional Amazonian practitioners, the ayahuasqueros, how their ancestors figured this out, the answer is almost uniform across different tribes and regions.
What do they say?
They claim the plants themselves taught them.
Wait, the plants?
Yeah. They say the knowledge came through plant dietas, through dreams, or through direct communication with the spirits of the jungle.
Which, to a strictly materialist Western scientific mind, sounds like magical thinking. We immediately dismiss it as unscientific.
We do. But we have to acknowledge the arrogance and the limits of our own scientific epistemology here. We look at this and say, well, we finally reverse engineered this in the mid-20th century, so now it's real science.
Right. Modern pharmacologists even created a synthetic version in the lab to prove it. They isolated pure crystalline DMT. They isolated a pure MAO inhibitor, like pharmaceutical harmine. They put them both in a synthetic capsule, and they dubbed it Pharmawasca.
Pharmawasca. It sounds like a Silicon Valley biohacking startup.
It really does. And when they tested this Pharmawasca in clinical settings, it perfectly reproduced the core psychedelic effect, right?
It did. It definitively proved, from a Western materialist standpoint, that this specific two-component lock-and-key mechanism is the sole biochemical reason the traditional brew works.
But while we credit the lab for isolating the molecules and drawing the chemical structures and proving the mechanism in a Petri dish, we often completely fail to appreciate the indigenous scientific method that discovered the synergy centuries, if not millennia, prior.
Exactly. However, that method was actually conducted, whether through deep, multi-generational empirical observation, incredibly refined ancestral knowledge transfer, or ways of interfacing with the ecology that we simply do not possess the vocabulary to understand.
They solved a complex biochemical puzzle long before mass spectrometers, microscopes, or the concept of molecular biology existed.
They mapped the neuropharmacology of the jungle through direct experience.
It really humbles you. It makes you realize that science isn't just guys in white coats in a sterile lab running double-blind trials. It's also generations of humans deeply observing and integrating with their ecosystem on a level of nuance we can barely fathom today.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we have firmly established that the vine acts as the bodyguard. It shuts down the bouncer so the leaf can get into the VIP lounge of the cerebral cortex.
Right.
But is the vine only a bodyguard? Or does it join the party once it gets inside the brain?
That is a crucial pharmacological distinction, and the source material is very clear on this. The vine is not just a passive biochemical gatekeeper.
It's not.
No. The beta carbolines, those harmala alkaloids we just discussed, are fully psychoactive in their own right, and they cross the blood-brain barrier right alongside the DMT.
So they aren't just holding the door open to the liver and gut. They are actively entering the brain and altering the neurochemistry.
Yes, and they fundamentally shape the character, the somatic feel, and the duration of the entire experience.
How so?
For example, harmaline, at higher concentrations, can produce very distinct, heavy, dreamlike effects. It is also largely responsible for the intense physical side effects.
Like the heavy body load and the tremors.
Exactly. And the profound nausea often associated with the brew.
And what about that third alkaloid, the one with the long name?
Tetrahydroharmine, THH.
THH.
This one is particularly fascinating because it acts as a mild serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or an SRI.
Let's pause and dig into that, because a lot of people take modern SSRIs for depression. What does an SRI actually do at the synaptic level?
Think about the synaptic cleft, the tiny gap between two neurons. When the presynaptic neuron wants to send a signal, it releases serotonin into that gap.
Okay, the serotonin floats across the gap.
Right, and it binds to the receptors on the postsynaptic neuron, triggering the signal. Normally, to keep the signal crisp and prevent overstimulation, you have transporter proteins, SERTs, that act like little vacuum cleaners.
Vacuum cleaners.
They immediately suck the serotonin back up into the first neuron to be recycled. This is called reuptake.
So the vacuum cleaner ensures the serotonin doesn't just sit there constantly pressing the doorbell.
Precisely. What THH does, as a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, is temporarily jam those vacuum cleaners.
Oh, wow.
It blocks the SERT transporters. So the serotonin that is naturally released into the synapse cannot be cleared away. It just lingers there, continually binding to the receptors, naturally elevating your background levels of synaptic serotonin.
So you have the DMT actively binding to and ringing the doorbell of the receptor, and at the exact same time, the THH is jamming the vacuum cleaners, ensuring that your own endogenous serotonin is heavily pooling in the synapses.
It is nudging the overall neurochemical environment in a very specific, sustained direction.
That is wild.
Therefore, as the OTW article points out, an ayahuasca trip is not just a long DMT trip.
It's not just DMT on a four-hour time delay.
No, not at all. It is a genuine combination pharmacology, a highly complex entourage effect. You have the visionary, highly visual, rapidly oscillating signal of the leaf. But layered heavily over that, you have the grounding, introspective, slow, emotionally saturated arc of the vine.
I like to think of this in terms of a band playing a song.
Okay, let's hear it.
If DMT is the lead singer, you know, just belting out these intense, visionary, reality-bending, high-frequency notes, taking up all the spotlight and attention.
Right.
The vine isn't just the microphone cord allowing the singer to be heard. The vine is the bass player.
Setting the rhythm and the underlying chord progression.
Right. The vine is laying down this heavy, deep, introspective groove. It's dictating the tempo and the emotional resonance of the entire track. Without the bass player, the lead singer might be technically impressive, maybe even overwhelmingly fast and chaotic, but the song has no weight, no emotional depth, no narrative structure. The vine gives the DMT experience its gravity and its therapeutic pacing.
That's a really brilliant analogy. And in modern pharmacology, we tend to overlook this kind of complex synergy. The entire pharmaceutical model is built on isolating a single active ingredient. We want the one specific molecule we can synthesize, patent, and put in a blister pack.
Right, keep it simple.
But plant medicines like ayahuasca force us to look at the entourage effect.
We hear that term a lot in cannabis research, actually, how THC interacts with CBD and various terpenes to create different effects.
It is the exact same principle, but operating on a much more profound level of consciousness alteration. It's the understanding that multiple active compounds interacting together can create a unique, dynamic neurological ecosystem that is vastly greater than the sum of its isolated parts.
You simply cannot look at the DMT in a vacuum. You have to look at how the DMT interacts with the harmine, the harmaline, and the THH, all simultaneously modulating different neurotransmitter systems in the human brain.
Yep.
So we have this incredibly complex, synergistic chemical cocktail. It has successfully navigated the harsh acidic environment of the stomach. It has tackled the MAO enzymes in the gut wall and liver. It has entered the systemic bloodstream, and it has crossed the blood-brain barrier. Let's look at the actual neuroscience of the trip. What exactly happens when this cocktail floods the cortex?
Once the DMT reaches the brain, it acts as a classic psychedelic. And by classic psychedelic, pharmacologists mean that its primary mechanism of action is acting as an agonist, an activator, at a very specific receptor site.
The serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
Yes, the 5-HT2A receptor.
The OETW journal calls this the master switch of the psychedelic state.
That is a highly accurate description. Whether you are talking about psilocybin from magic mushrooms, LSD, mescaline from peyote, or DMT, this specific receptor subtype, which is densely concentrated on the apical dendrites of pyramidal neurons in layer 5 of the cortex, is the primary doorway to the experience.
Layer 5 of the cortex.
When DMT binds to the 5-HT2A receptor, it alters the firing rate of these deeply influential neurons, initiating a massive cascade of changes in how different large-scale regions of the brain communicate with each other.
And we can actually see this happening in real time now, thanks to functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI.
We can.
When people are put into an fMRI machine while under the influence of ayahuasca, what do the brain scans actually show? Is the whole brain just lighting up with activity, or are certain parts shutting down?
It's actually a highly specific pattern of both. One of the most significant and consistent findings in neuroimaging studies of the psychedelic state is the profound alteration of activity in what is known as the default mode network, or DMN.
The default mode network. This concept comes up constantly in psychedelic science, but let's really ground it for a second. What is the DMN doing for us on a normal, sober Tuesday afternoon?
The default mode network is essentially a heavily interconnected network of brain regions, including the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex, that is most active when you are awake, but not actively focused on a specific task in the outside world.
So it's when you're just zoning out.
Yeah, its resting metabolic rate is very high. It is active when you are daydreaming, when you are recalling autobiographical memories, when you are projecting into the future to worry about tomorrow, and crucially, when you are thinking about yourself.
It is the self-referential system.
It is intimately, biologically tied to your ordinary sense of me, your ego, your autobiographical narrative, the continuous story you tell yourself about who you are, what your personality is, what you like, what you fear, your rigid habits of thought. All of that self-construct is heavily mediated by the functional connectivity of the default mode network.
I always picture the DMN as this incredibly strict, overbearing corporate middle manager in your brain.
A middle manager, huh?
Yeah, this manager is constantly walking around the office of your mind with a clipboard, enforcing the rules of who you are. Saying things like, no, remember, we don't like public speaking, shut that idea down. Or, hey, don't forget, we're still deeply angry about that rejection that happened 5 years ago. Keep that file open.
Constantly auditing your thoughts.
Exactly. This is the route we take to work. This is how we react to stress. Do not deviate from the company manual.
Yeah.
It is constantly keeping all the different creative departments of your brain strictly siloed, forcing them to operate according to a very narrow, highly efficient, but very rigid set of rules.
The DMN is an evolutionary necessity, though. It maintains order, cognitive efficiency, and a cohesive sense of self so you can navigate complex social hierarchies.
Sure, you need a manager.
Right. But it can also become pathological. It can become overly rigid, keeping you trapped in severe negative thought loops, anxiety, or depression.
So what happens to this strict middle manager when the DMT and the harmalas hit the 5-HT2A receptors?
Under ayahuasca, the fMRI scans show that the blood oxygen level dependence signal, the BOLD signal, in the DMN drops significantly.
Its metabolic activity just plummets.
Yes. More importantly, its tight internal coupling, the rigid control it has over itself and other networks, loosens dramatically.
Ayahuasca basically sends the middle manager on a mandatory sudden vacation. The clipboard is thrown out the window.
And when that top-down regulatory control drops, something incredible happens to the rest of the brain. The brain enters a state of higher entropy.
Entropy, meaning disorder or randomness.
In a sense, yes, neurological flexibility. Simultaneously, communication across normally separate, highly siloed brain networks dramatically increases.
So while the manager's away, all the different departments in the office suddenly realize the doors are unlocked and they start talking to each other directly.
Exactly. Regions of the brain that rarely, if ever, communicate with each other in a sober state are suddenly forming hyper-connected transient functional pathways.
That sounds chaotic, but amazing.
The visual cortex is talking directly to the emotional processing centers. Deeply repressed episodic memories are being accessed without the usual filters of self-judgment or fear. The brain becomes much more globally interconnected, while the specific network responsible for the self goes offline.
They are freely sharing old files, uncovering forgotten memories, and collaborating in entirely new, unprecedented ways.
And this specific neurological signature, this profound drop in DMN activity, combined with massive global hyperconnectivity, is the physical biological correlate of what is often described subjectively in trip reports as ego dissolution.
Ego dissolution, when you literally forget that you are you.
When the rigid boundary between self and other, between subject and object, temporarily falls away.
Wow.
And it perfectly explains why ayahuasca is so universally famous for surfacing deep autobiographical and emotional material. Without the DMN constantly suppressing or heavily filtering those memories to fit your current, perhaps traumatized narrative, they rise to the surface of consciousness to be witnessed and processed in a completely new light.
If we connect this to the bigger clinical picture, this isn't just fascinating abstract neuroscience. It has profound medical implications. The fact that ayahuasca achieves this exact same DMN suppression and global hyperconnectivity via an oral route opens up profound possibilities for addressing psychological conditions that are fundamentally rooted in rigid, maladaptive thinking.
This specific mechanism of action naturally caught the attention of clinical researchers and psychiatrists. They looked at this temporary dissolution of rigid neural pathways and thought, wait, what if we could harness this to treat the most stubborn, entrenched psychological ailments? Which brings us to the modern clinical frontier.
And the data here is moving rapidly from anecdotal jungle retreat stories to highly rigorous peer-reviewed science. The OOTW article highlights a landmark study published in 2019 by a team of researchers in Brazil, led by Fernanda Pojano Fontes. I want to really dig into this study because the parameters of it are vital for understanding the medical promise here. This wasn't just a survey of healthy people who went to a yoga retreat and drank the brew.
No, this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. That is the absolute gold standard of clinical research methodology.
They took 29 patients. And these weren't just people feeling a little down or experiencing mild seasonal affective disorder. The article specifically notes they were suffering from treatment-resistant depression.
The clinical gravity of the term treatment-resistant depression, or TRD, cannot be overstated. These are patients for whom traditional first-line therapies have completely failed.
Meaning they have tried standard SSRIs, SNRIs, perhaps atypical antipsychotics, or even electroconvulsive therapy. They have taken standard daily pills for months or years, and their depression has not lifted.
Their scores on depression rating scales remain severely high. They are, in a very real clinical sense, stuck.
Completely stuck. Their default mode network, to use our earlier analogy, is locked into a severely negative, rigid narrative of self-loathing, hopelessness, and rumination that no conventional chemical intervention has been able to disrupt.
Exactly. So in this trial, the researchers gave these treatment-resistant patients a single, carefully measured dose of ayahuasca.
So what does this all mean? A single dose. One session lasting maybe 6 hours. What were the results on their depression scores compared to the placebo group?
The single dose of ayahuasca produced rapid and statistically significant antidepressant effects compared to the placebo. And what is truly remarkable, what shifts the entire paradigm, is the timeline of these results.
The timeline.
Yes, these profound positive effects were measured at 1 day, 2 days, and 7 days post-session.
I really want to pause and emphasize how radical that is. Because if you think about traditional psychiatric medication like SSRIs, they generally take weeks, sometimes 4 to 8 weeks, of chronic daily dosing just to build up enough in your system to start showing a mild clinical benefit.
It's a slow, chronic, highly delayed intervention. And during those weeks, the side effects can be brutal.
Right. So the ability of a single dose of a psychedelic compound to provide rapid, massive relief within 24 hours, and for that relief to be sustained for days or weeks afterward, is completely contrary to how psychiatry has treated depression for the last 50 years.
It's mirroring the wider psychedelic renaissance we are seeing with psilocybin at institutions like Johns Hopkins and Imperial College London. Fast onset, single session benefit, and lasting neuroplasticity that heavily outlasts the actual drug in the system.
Because at day 7, the DMT and the harmolas are long gone from the bloodstream.
They are completely metabolized and eliminated by the liver within hours. But the clinical effect remains. Because during that 4 to 6 hour window when the DMN was heavily suppressed, the brain was forced into a period of heightened neuroplasticity.
The rigid grooves of depressive thought were temporarily smoothed out.
Yes, and neurotrophic factors were released, allowing the patient to establish healthier, more flexible neural pathways.
It's like, well, if you've ever felt completely stuck in a mental rut, right? Imagine you were driving a car on a muddy, unpaved dirt road, and the tires of hundreds of cars before you have worn these deep, deep trenches into the mud.
You're physically stuck in the tracks. The road dictates where the car goes.
No matter how hard you turn the steering wheel, the car just stays in those deep, rutted grooves. Traditional daily medication is like slowly, day by day, shoveling a tiny little bit of dirt into the grooves, hoping that eventually, maybe 2 months from now, the road will be flat enough for you to steer out of the rut.
And the psychedelic intervention.
It's like a heavy lift helicopter swoops in, picks up your entire car, and sets it down on a freshly paved, wide open highway.
Oh, wow.
It physically and chemically forces your brain out of its habitual depressed grooves within a matter of hours. The rut is technically still there in the mud, back on the old road, but you aren't stuck in it anymore. You have the immediate cognitive freedom to drive in a new direction.
That neuroplastic window, that period of structural and functional flexibility, is the key to the therapeutic outcome. But as profoundly hopeful as this clinical data is, and as beautiful as that analogy is, it is absolutely crucial that we do not romanticize this intervention.
Oh, absolutely not.
Because the ability to powerfully disrupt and rewrite brain networks comes with a massive, very serious caveat.
It absolutely does. And this is where we have to look at the other side of the pharmacological coin. I want to push back on the hype a bit, because the very biochemical trick that makes this medicine biologically possible, that elegant locking up of the MAO bouncer in the liver, is also exactly what makes this brew remarkably dangerous and potentially fatal if it is not respected.
It is the ultimate double-edged sword of pharmacology. An MAO inhibitor is not a supplement. It is not something to be trifled with.
It is a highly serious, system-altering pharmacological agent.
In fact, early pharmaceutical antidepressants in the mid-20th century were MAOIs, and they were largely phased out of first-line psychiatric use precisely because they require incredibly strict dietary and medication management to avoid lethal complications.
Let's break down those severe risks, starting with diet. Why does temporarily shutting down the MAO enzyme in our gut affect what we can eat?
Remember earlier when we said MAO's day job is breaking down monoamines, including dietary amines? One of those specific dietary amines is called tyramine.
Tyramine? Where do we typically find that in a normal diet?
It is a naturally occurring trace amine found in high concentrations in aged, fermented, or cured foods. Think aged cheeses like cheddar or blue cheese, cured meats like salami or prosciutto, fermented foods like sauerkraut or soy sauce, and even certain types of tap beer and red wine.
So charcuterie board staples.
Exactly. Normally, your gut MAO oxidizes and breaks down tyramine harmlessly before it can do anything. But if you have taken an MAOI, like the Harmala alkaloids in ayahuasca, the tyramine cannot be broken down. It enters your systemic bloodstream in massive, unregulated quantities.
And what does a massive flood of tyramine actually do to the body?
It acts as a releasing agent for norepinephrine. It floods your sympathetic nervous system, causing your blood vessels to constrict rapidly and violently, leading to dangerous, potentially life-threatening blood pressure spikes. In medical literature, this is known as the cheese effect.
The cheese effect. It sounds almost funny, like a mild stomach ache.
Right.
But a hypertensive crisis is no joke.
It's extremely serious.
You could literally suffer a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a stroke, or a myocardial infarction simply because you ate a charcuterie board before drinking the brew.
Precisely. The cardiovascular strain can be catastrophic, but diet is only half the risk profile. The pharmaceutical medication interactions are even more severe and act much faster.
Let's talk about that. The Source article heavily emphasizes the danger of combining the brew with serotonergic drugs. What happens mechanically in the brain there?
If a person is taking a daily SSRI for depression or an SNRI or even certain triptan medications for migraines, their brain synapses already have artificially elevated levels of serotonin because the reuptake transporters are blocked.
Right.
If you introduce ayahuasca on top of that baseline, you are adding an MAOI, which completely stops the enzymatic breakdown of serotonin, and you are adding THH, which is itself another reuptake inhibitor, and you are adding DMT, which floods and agonizes the 5-HT2A receptors.
It's a massive multi-front traffic jam of serotonin. You are stimulating the receptors, blocking the cleanup crew, and shutting down the recycling plant all at once.
It leads to a highly dangerous neurological condition called serotonin syndrome.
Serotonin syndrome.
The central and peripheral nervous systems are overwhelmed by a toxic level of serotonin. Symptoms escalate rapidly from shivering, heavy sweating, and confusion to hyperreflexia, severe hyperthermia, seizures, and in severe cases, it can be rapidly fatal.
Fatal. That is the hard pharmacological reason why strict dietary and medication screening before entering a clinical trial or traditional ceremony is completely non-negotiable.
It is not just a shamanic suggestion to make the trip more pure. It is a vital, life-or-death medical necessity based on hard biochemistry.
I really want to highlight a common fallacy here because it drives me crazy. There is this pervasive idea in modern wellness culture that because something is natural or ancient or plant-based, it is inherently gentle, safe, and nurturing. People think, oh, it's just a traditional tea made from a vine and a leaf harvested in the jungle. It's natural plant medicine and can't hurt me like synthetic pharma pills.
That's a very common misconception.
But I have to point out that a heart attack from serotonin syndrome induced by a jungle vine is just as natural and just as deadly as a heart attack from a synthetic street drug.
That is a critical point that often gets lost in the psychedelic renaissance. The naturalistic fallacy is incredibly dangerous, especially when dealing with highly potent psychoactives. Nature is full of highly sophisticated, highly lethal chemistry.
Right.
Hemlock is completely natural. Cyanide is natural. Botulinum toxin is natural. Natural does not mean safe. It just means it was synthesized by a plant instead of a chemist.
Exactly. And the indigenous cultures who have used this brew for centuries understand this deeply. They don't view it as a casual wellness supplement. When you look at traditional ayahuasca practices in the Amazon, they have incredibly strict dietary and behavioral rules, known as the dieta, that participants and the healers themselves must follow for days or even weeks beforehand.
They restrict certain foods, salts, meat, sexual activity, and other behaviors.
Right. And when we look at those rules through the lens of modern biochemistry, we see that these strict dietary restrictions aren't just arbitrary spiritual dogma.
Not at all. They are critical, highly evolved survival protocols wrapped in cultural ritual. The indigenous practitioners essentially codified MAOI dietary safety into their religious and cultural practice long before Western science discovered what tyramine or norepinephrine even were.
That is incredible. They built a highly accurate pharmacological safety manual into their cultural rituals, ensuring no one died of a hypertensive crisis during a ceremony.
They did. The pharmacology demands ultimate respect, and their traditions reflect that deep respect. We also have to mention the grueling physical reality of the experience itself. The article specifically mentions la purga,
the purge, intense vomiting, and frequently diarrhea.
Yes. The harmala alkaloids in the vine, particularly harmaline, are highly emetic. They strongly induce vomiting. In traditional contexts, this is considered a normal, even essential part of the ceremony, a physical, emotional, and spiritual cleansing of negative energy.
But from a purely physiological and medical standpoint, hours of intense vomiting and diarrhea pose real dehydration and electrolyte imbalance risks, right?
Exactly, especially in a hot, humid jungle environment away from modern medical care.
And beyond the acute physical risks, there are the severe psychological ones. The article notes that, like all classic psychedelics, this brew can dangerously destabilize individuals with a personal or family history of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, or psychosis.
Suppressing the default mode network and opening up the mind to that massive flood of cross-network communication can be incredibly therapeutic for a rigid, depressed brain that needs to be shaken out of a rut.
Yeah.
But for a brain that is already prone to mania or to a loose association with consensus reality, completely dissolving the ego boundaries and flooding the system with entropy can trigger severe, long-lasting psychiatric episodes. It is a powerful tool, and like any powerful tool, it is absolutely not for everyone.
Bringing all of these diverse elements together, from the MAO bouncer at the gut wall to the VIP lounge of the 5-HT2A receptors, from indigenous survival rituals honed over centuries to modern double-blind fMRI clinical trials in Brazil, it leaves us with this profound new understanding of our complex biological relationship with the natural world.
It beautifully bridges the gap between ancient empirical botanical knowledge and cutting-edge molecular neuroscience.
We started today with a biological paradox. The mystery of oral DMT being dead on arrival, thanks to first-pass metabolism. We uncover the genius two-plant trick, pairing the DMT-rich chacruna leaf with the MAO-inhibiting copy vine to temporarily patch our own digestive software. We explored how the resulting chemical cocktail acts on the brain, suppressing the default mode network and leading to the phenomenon of ego dissolution.
And we saw the incredible paradigm-shifting promise this holds for rapidly treating stubborn, treatment-resistant depression.
And finally, we face the stark reality that the very chemistry that makes it work also demands rigorous physical and psychiatric respect.
The complexity of it all is truly staggering. It is a multi-part botanical masterclass in pharmacology.
Which leaves me with a final lingering thought for you, the listener, to mull over. We spent this entire deep dive marveling at the statistical impossibility of a pre-scientific society pinpointing this exact, highly complex biochemical lock-and-key mechanism out of tens of thousands of random plants in the Amazon. If they could figure that out through means we still barely comprehend.
What else is out there?
And exactly. What other incredible multi-part pharmacological cures for our most intractable diseases are currently sitting undiscovered in the natural world right now, just waiting for us to figure out the trick?
The jungle is a vast, largely untranslated pharmacological laboratory.
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.